Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June the 7th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Chuck Huff, continuing his five-part series on psych fallacies. Today, session 5 is entitled All You Need Is Love. Let's listen in.
My name's Chuck Huff. The title of this fifth in a series of sessions is Psychological Fallacies. All You Need Is Love. And I don't know that we need to sing it all in unison, but it is at least a nice song. First caveat that I'd like to give is that I'm a social psychologist, which means that I study how people get along with each other, or don't, as the case may be. And I'm not a clinical or a counseling psychologist. And that means that I don't do therapy. Most of my expertise comes from either doing research or reading research that my colleagues have done, or from some small experience that I've had in organizations talking with people about teamwork in groups and those sorts of things. When I say that the series is on fallacies, what I mean is that it's on things that are popularly believed, but that are usually more, at least more complicated than the common wisdom suggests. So we've talked about some fallacies, like we use 10% of our brain, that are simply basically wrong. But there are other fallacies that are partly true, that, for instance, that you should get your anger out, but that are much more complicated than you might think once you really begin getting in to finding out how anger works and what it does within and to people. Now I want to do something that might sound a little strange given the topic, but I want to talk about two separate areas. I hope we can get to both of them. One of them is intimate relations, which is what the song was about, that, you know, to get along in a close relationship with another person, all you needed was love. The other thing I want to talk about, though, is the reduction of prejudice in our society, and it's commonly thought that in that instance also all you need is love. All you have to do is to get together with other people and be nice, and prejudice will be reduced. And we find out as we look at attempts to reduce prejudice over the years that in fact that's not true. You have to be much more intentional and careful in attempts to reduce prejudice. And we can get into that later. One of the graphs that I find most interesting. There's a book, if you're interested in intimate relations, which most people are, but if you're interested in reading more, there's a book by Sharon Brem, B-R-E-H-M, called Intimate Relations. Or is it intimate relationships? If you get that close, you'll find it. That has a lot of the research that I'm going to be talking about in it, and way more than I can do because the book is about yay thick, an inch or so thick. It's a very nice text. It's readable. It's actually written in English. As opposed to what social scientists usually write in, which I'm not sure what it is. Maybe our linguists can tell us. Jargon.
It's tricky because it uses English-like words.
Yes. And I would, I'd highly recommend it. Another thought that occurred to me this morning, I don't know if we want to go into it in any detail, is that one, it might be interesting to take the research on intimate relationships that Sharon Brem talks about in her book and ask about the extent to which we can apply that research to our relationship with God as a metaphor. But that's about as far as I'm willing to go today on that one. Anyway, if you're interested in it, the book by Sharon Brim is really excellent. There's a graph that shows up about midway through that text. This is the satisfaction that people report with their intimate relationship with one other person over time, where time here is considered years. We start with, you know, zero all the way out to 50, 60, 70 years that people are with each other. And interestingly, the research suggests that you get something like an inverted U-curve over time. What I want to talk about in order to suggest all of the various things that we need in addition to love is what things help to push this curve around. It's an easy way to talk about the things you can add to a relationship that help to make a difference in people's happiness with their relationship. For folks that are on the tape, the curve that I just drew starts pretty high early in the relationship and then drops down. And towards the end, it comes up a little, but it never quite goes up as far as it starts at the beginning. One of the differences in the curve I'd like to talk about initially is this part right here that seems to be much higher than the rest of it. And that suggests a difference between two different kinds of love that y'all may have heard of in conversation. Let me write them up on the board. They are passionate love and companionate. And the names really suggest what they're about. One of the interesting things about passionate love is that in the work that people have done asking people about their perceptions of the other, etc., when they talk about being passionately in love, they have found that passionate love is built on two different things. It's built on uncertainty about the other. That is, are we going to keep... How are things going now? And it's also built on a idealized construction of the other. It's built on a construction of the other, usually, that's based in not as intimate knowledge of their lives as you get later on in a long-term relationship. I want to say also that the research here applies pretty equally to heterosexual and homosexual relationships. It's if in talking I bump across something that I know there's a difference between heterosexual and homosexual relationships, and there are some, I'll try to bring them up. And if you're interested in those differences, I'll be happy to talk about them later. Or you can just go get Sharon Brim's book, and she talks about some of those differences. But the research suggests that, not surprisingly, since both heterosexual and homosexual people are people, you get similar issues in close relationships among all of them. And so this distinction between passion and companionate love helps us to understand one of the reasons why things start out really high. There's an interesting irony that some folks have pointed out, and that is that people often get married at the height of their attraction to another person, which suggests, of course, that the only other way to go after they get married is down. As they really begin to discover what's going on. Having said that, I don't want to suggest that that means that it's better to live with someone for a while before you get married to find out what they're like. There has been just a raft of research on that issue. And in general, what folks find is that people who live together, even for substantial periods of time, have no advantage in terms of the longevity of the relationship over people who don't live together. So in all the research, what we find is that the common belief that living together ahead of time in order to get to know each other, at least across all couples, doesn't work. Now, that doesn't mean for particular couples it might not be a good idea or might not be a bad idea. But in general, it's untrue that it's a good thing to live together for a while to figure out what's going on. One of the things the researchers have suggested produces this dip right in the middle of the curve. I was talking with Deanne the other day about why it was she was groaning. I thought perhaps she'd been on the trail up to Copper Basin or something. And she said, no, it's just 40. Then later in the day, she was talking about being very, very tired. And we suggested that one of the reasons that she might be very, very tired instead of 40 was 4, which is the age of her son. These are the years that children are in long relationships. And the research suggests that what children do is reduce people's satisfaction with their relationship with each other. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not a good thing to have them. Right? All it means is that you need to be aware of that if you plan to have them. You need to plan for it. And you're going to have to think about what the other things are. This is only, we've only got one dimension up here, satisfaction with a relationship between two people. And there's a whole bunch of other things that are good about having children and about relationships. So, but one of the things that marriage counselors talk with people about before they get married is the myth that as they add more children to the family, they will all just increase all of their happiness. What you do is increase pressure on the family. There's more things to do. There are more economic strains. There are more strains in terms of time. All of those things. Speaking of which, this dip is generally true, or is more true, only if people lower on the socioeconomic scale. Mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, people who are higher on socioeconomic scale, who have more money, can use money to help resolve some of those time and economic conflicts. They have enough money to spend on the children, and they have enough money to buy services to help deal with the time conflict issues. So, crassly, at least money helps in relationships, and it's important to think about that issue. One of the nice things about having data like this is that you can say this to folks with a little graph, and it seems to have more impact than simply saying, well, where are you going to get a job? Because it's not like you're complaining, but you have some external thing. It's sort of like the way the Jesuits for years have used the Enneagram. The Jesuits say that one of the reasons that they like the Enneagram a lot is because after doing the Enneagram with a person, they can say lots of things to them that might take a whole lot longer if they didn't have some external thing to point at. So having data like this to talk with people about their marriages makes it a little easier. It doesn't sound just like you're pontificating. Another thing that can change this dip in the middle of the curve that happens with children, and this is related to socioeconomic status, is the roles that individuals play in the family. So if one of the people are able to stay home and spend a lot of the time with the children, and this can differ in cultures, right? I mean, in some pastoral cultures, you spend a lot of time at home doing your work anyway. But role conflicts can really be quite difficult. Now, I want to suggest, though, that the issue of role conflict when children come into a relationship is more complex than you might initially think it is. It's not just all bad news. What folks who have looked at role conflict among women in the United States have been finding is that there are kinds of roles outside of the house that you get, you get a role complement effect for women in families, rather than simply a conflict. Not surprisingly, that often has to do with work out of the house that the woman finds meaningful. And it's not just working outside the house. People in difficult economic straits where the woman works at menial labor that she doesn't find interesting or self-fulfilling don't get this role complement. It's not like going out and getting any job produces this role complement effect. But it's only meaningful work that produces the role complement effect. That's also true for men, that if they have work outside of a relationship, that you get a complement effect, but only if they find that meaningful. Now, let me generalize for a minute. There's also data on this other thing from that, but suggest that there's a connection between that and relationships outside of a relationship, too. And there are ways that relationships outside of a relationship can both hinder and help the particular relationship that you have. And partly, again, like we were talking about anger, much of this has to do with being intentional about the way that you structure your life. Sometimes you can't be, because you're in such severe economic straits that you simply have to take whatever job you can get. But to the extent that you can be intentional, it's important to think about the effects of these outside relationships, both with jobs and other people, that impinge upon you. We've talked some about communication. When people talk about long-term relationships, one of the things that is most important is communication. There's three chapters on that in Sharon Brim's book, and so we can't really do that well here, other than have me to point it out that being able to talk with each other is really quite important. Yeah.
What about companionate? That's a new word for me.
Oh, okay. Companionate love is love. I'm sorry that I didn't. Define that better for you. Companionate love is love that isn't the sort where you feel like you feel lighthearted and giddy and or can be knocked over with a feather, etc. Oh, there was a film.
I was just going to ask you some this similar to like in Fiddler on the Roof. when the episode when the wife comes to her husband and says, "Do you love me?" And he answers back, "Well, what do you mean, do I love you? Haven't I provided you a home and you children and done all these things?" But she keeps saying, "Do you love me?" And he was talking on his companionate level, and I think she was talking on the compassionate level. Do you have the emotional? And
well, yeah, in fact, there are... There's a variety of dimensions that your comment, that both of y'all's comments bring up. When people generally talk about companion love, what they mean is a long-lasting, sincere caring for the other person, but that is not obsessive the way that passionate love is obsessive, where you're always thinking about the other. And one of the interesting things that your comment brings up is that, in fact, there are some very clear, at least in American culture, and I don't know the extent of the research in other cultures, gender differences in the way people perceive love.
Mm-hmm.
Men very often think of showing love as doing things for the other person. One of the most fascinating bits of research that I know that to suggest this difference is some work that was done by some researchers with couples in which they asked couples to change their communication strategies over time, etc., to find out what the effects of this kind of work would be. And one week they explained some of these gender differences in love to the families. And they asked the men to be more expressive about their love to their wives.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, all of the wives' ratings of their feeling loved, feeling more satisfied with their relationship went up, except for two couples. And this puzzled the researchers, so they called the fellows up in the couples. And the one I liked the most was the fellow who said, "Well, sure, I washed her car for her." "Doesn't that show I loved her?" And they said, "No, you don't get it." What we meant was... That's right. Please listen to the instructions. So that fellow was clearly interpreting love, and he loved her. And he showed his love by doing a thing rather than by saying things, by communicating verbally his love to her. And it's important for people to recognize those differences, not because what we ought to do is let people fall into them, but because we each ought to try to work to understand the other and to provide the other with the things that they need. Very often what you find in couples where people are quite in love with each other and really want to help is if we're in love, I give you what I want.
Yes.
And you give me what you want.
Like in a TV show I watched the other day, comedy, this guy was trying to buy a present for the anniversary, and he couldn't think of it. But his neighbor said, "Never buy your wife something that you plug in." You know, like a new refrigerator or a new something like that.
Yes. I remember buying my mother a hamster for Mother's Day. I thought that was great. It chewed its way into her best pillow.
Are these not the eros and agape of the three or four kinds of love that are described there being fraternity and agape?
Yeah, these don't map on as easily to the different distinctions in kinds of love that the Greeks talked about. Again, they're a different way of cutting the pie up. Although interestingly, the Greeks viewed passionate love as a kind of sickness. They thought that it was a kind of mental illness. And perhaps it is. I mean, maybe that's a good way to talk about it.
And that was the Greek word eros, so that's where we get our erotic
that's
and
right.
stuff like that from.
That's right. And there is a sort of madness associated with passionate love, with this single-minded desire for the other. Mm-hmm. But when, and what many couples get worried about is when that passionate love disappears, they say, gosh, this is what my culture has always told me a relationship is supposed to be about. That's gone away. Does that mean we've failed? We could also think about that in terms of our relationship with God. Sometimes that passion goes away. Does it mean we don't love God anymore? I don't know. It would be interesting to think about companionate love with God instead of compassionate love, instead of passionate love.
I think that's sort of like the mountaintop experience. You can't stay up on top of the mountain forever.
Well,
you have to come out.
It's certainly quite wearying to be passionately in love.
Yeah.
Having experienced it recently, I can tell you that.
So, one's relationship with God, you can have the mountaintop experiences, but eventually you get down to the plains and then you're on the companionate.
Yes. You know, I want to move to another model of relationships that suggests just how complicated it is really to understand what's going on in we were just talking about one dependent, or one measure of the goodness of a relationship, and that was people's expression of how satisfied they were with it. This model has got a whole bunch of other things involved in it. We talk very crassly. People very often do think about the rewards and the costs of the relationships that they're in. Early in relationships, usually people think mostly about the rewards. Mm-hmm. That's partly because they haven't figured out what the costs are.
Yeah.
And later in the relationship,
cost of food.
That's right. And later in the relationship, they begin to find out. There's another issue. And that is the comparison level, which is how good have things been for us in the past? Right? How, where might we be able to go within our relationship? Do we think things can get better? Have they gotten worse in the past? So change in the relationship. And if you put thoughts about, if you put those three together, the researchers who've come up with this model say that that determines mostly people's reported satisfaction, T-I-O-N, with a relationship. But that's not the only thing that's involved in whether a couple stays together for any length of time. Another issue is the alternatives that are available. To use an unhappy example, one of the reasons many women stay in battering relationships is that they can't imagine that the alternatives are any better. And of course, their batterers attempt to convince them that there are no better alternatives, and in fact, to leave would be more dangerous than to stay would be. So it's not just your satisfaction, it's also whether you think there are alternatives outside. Do you think there are other places that you might be able to get the kind of satisfaction that you like? And in addition, there's an issue that these researchers call investment. And investment has to do with things that you have put into a relationship that you know that you'll lose if you leave. Public commitment, for instance, produces investment. That's why we have marriage ceremonies in front of bunches of people that you're likely to see again and who are closely related to you, so that you put yourself out there and say, yes, I promise that I'm going to do all of these things. That produces investment in a relationship. Time that you've put in with a person is an investment in a relationship, and it's a thing that you can't get back. There are a whole raft of investments that we put into a relationship. Let me suggest two other ways of cutting our pie up as we think about kinds of relations. And that is equity relationships and C-O-M-M-U-N, communal relationships. In equity relationships, which is when you go out for dinner or lunch with some friends, people are careful to keep track of the tab and figure out who has paid what, and if one person pays once, then the other person is supposed to pay the next time, etc. Communal relationships are ones in which people have a lot of investment. They don't count as much, these issues of reward minus cost. And instead, they think about more long-term issues of the benefit to the partner. So they really are two very different ways. One of the things that happens in relationships is they fall apart. Is that they often move from communal to equity, and people begin counting what's going on. And that in itself signals a kind of withdrawal from a relationship. So those are a whole raft of things that are in addition to love that we need to think about as we think about our close personal relationships with other people. I want to move to the contact hypothesis, as psychologists have called it. And the contact hypothesis is the hypothesis that if people are prejudiced against each other, all you really need to do is to put them in contact with each other, and that will help to reduce the prejudice, it will reduce the strains of conflict, etc. It is basically not true. In order for contact between groups to work to reduce prejudice, you need a whole bunch of other constraints to make that contact work. Let me give you an example of work that Elliot Aronson has done in the public schools in Texas. He did this in the late 60s when the Texas schools were integrating. Not surprisingly, as you saw in many schools in the South and in the North, as schools integrated after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, conflict in the schools actually went up. There's a great deal of prejudice between members of different races. In Texas, it was partly, there certainly was issues with blacks, but Texas had the additional burden of dealing with a large Hispanic population. And so people were pointing to the schools saying, see, integration doesn't work. What you've done is simply stir up the pot and make people madder at each other. Elliot Aronson went in and produced and put together, with his knowledge of the research on this issue, a program called the Jigsaw Classroom. And there's a book by that name that Elliot Aronson is the first author of, published in either the early 70s or the late 60s. And what he did was to break the classrooms up, make different goals, and make it so that people had to cooperate with each other to produce a common goal, which was learning. And that they had to cooperate with people of the other race in order to achieve that common goal. And they did lots of measures of prejudice and of violence in the schools, and all of those went down after they implemented this method. Let me give you some clues about the kinds of things that were involved in that. The research is based on some classic studies that were done, I think many of them were done in Arkansas. They're called the Robber's Cave studies, because it was a campsite that was near where Jesse James and some other people used to hide out. These are social psychologists, Musbah Sharif and some other folks, who brought kids together to a summer camp. And the whole summer camp was a social psychological experiment. They took the kids, these were done in the late 40s, early 50s. They pre-screened the kids to make sure that they didn't have people in their group who were particularly strange on a variety of psychological variables. And they broke them up into groups. And they looked and they watched how the hostility between groups emerged. And you find this happens in almost all junior high schools. As soon as you put people together in groups, they begin to think of their group as better than others. In fact, social psychologists have done some research in which they have taken college students and other subjects, randomly divided them into groups by dice throws, and you still find that people are willing to say that their group is better than the other one. So this feeling of our group being better than the other is very deeply rooted in our psyche, and we're willing to attach it even to meaningless groups.
It must be, I'm in it.
You're in the in group.
Yeah, that's right. Because I'm there.
That's right. And it's the best group. And in fact, that's one of the things. That's one of the some of the work that has been done, which that suggests that what it is it's a connection to personal self-concept and self-esteem. Is that in order for us to feel good about ourselves, we use the groups that we're in, and we can do that two ways. We can make the group that we're in look good, or we can make that the group that we're not in look worse than us. And we do it both ways. Some of the fascinating work that's been done suggests that people, even in what we call these minimal groups, where they've been divided up randomly or based on some whether they were right or wrong and guessing the number of jelly beans in a jar, even in those minimal groups, people are willing to win less in order to win more than the other group. Did that make sense? Excuse me?
Say it again, please.
They were willing to win less in a game in order to win more than the other group. So if they had a choice between two situations where they got 6 points and the other group got 6 points, or $6 and they've done it with money, or their group gets $4 and the other group gets $2, people on average choose the one where they get more than the other group. It's a very persistent and strange phenomenon. You find this, there's been some interesting work on this with labor negotiations, and many labor unions are willing to take raises only if it's clear that they'll make more money than other people will. So if the carpenters will make more money than the laborers, but they don't want to have equal wages when they feel like there are status differences in their groups. It's a fascinating phenomenon. Yes.
Good example of that is in our last labor negotiations. One of the things that the people asked for was that in the trades, that journeymen who had been there, 5 years or whatever, mm-hmm. should get more than the starting journeyman.
Right.
Well, negotiation came through and everything was up and down and up and down. And the company was, winning everything. And they came to the final offer, and we was offered this much this is what the journeyman would get.
Mm-hmm.
And our negotiators said, well, we've... one of the things they asked for is for the senior journeyman to get kind of a bonus package. So what they came up with is the company said, okay, instead of paying, they offered to pay all of us that much. They said, we'll pay the junior journeyman's less.
So you can pay more.
Yeah. You senior journeymen
are going
to get this bonus. And
yeah.
I was willing to accept less.
That's right. Yeah, and you find that all over.
Yeah.
That kind of attachment to an in-group. So one of the things that suggests is that attachment to your in-group is really a very strong thing. And simple contact with members of the other group is not likely to overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's some of the rules that have come up from this large body of research. Two things that go together that you need to have if you bring two groups together are mutual interdependence and a common goal. Let me suggest one reason why church remains as segregated as it does. Many people have said that the 11 to 12 hour on Sunday is the most segregated hour in the United States. One of the reasons that it's segregated is less because of prejudice and more because of different cultural preferences for styles of liturgy. And you find those cultural preferences for styles of liturgy work with racial differences in the United States. And so people go to churches where they're comfortable. The way to overcome this segregation among churches isn't simply to wag our fingers at people and say, now you go be with those other people. But in fact, the way to overcome it is to produce some mutual interdependence and with a common goal, so that you ask churches in an area to work together to help to feed the poor, or to work together to help overcome some social problem, or to work together to put on something. And that will produce a breaking down of the barriers, rather than simply saying, now y'all go love each other and have a potluck supper. And we don't do that. Instead, we stay in groups that are comfortable. And since we don't see the other group, we end up not feeling particularly bad about being segregated. Another important issue, if you want to reduce prejudice between groups, is that the contacts have to be equal status contacts. They can't be contacts where the white church runs the show and the black church people are expected to show up and do the cooking. Mm-hmm. But they have to be contacts in which people are treated as equal in status, and in which there's a social norm of equality in status. So it's not just that it happens to be equal, but that together we affirm that we ought all to be equal, because people will fall in once they figure out what the social norms are. Another thing that needs to come about another constraint on intergroup contacts that will help reduce prejudice is that those contacts need to be interpersonal and informal. So they need to not simply be sitting down on either side of a labor negotiation table, or not simply coming together for a formal worship service where people will sit closest to their friends, but they need to be in kinds of interaction where people end up actually having to talk and to interact with members of the other group, rather than simply sit next to them. Yeah.
Another example, I belong to a group called Northwest Medical Teams, and it's a group that originally was started to help people medically, but then the organizers realized that there's lots of, you know, just common workers could go down. And they
help with sanitation and things like that. Right.
They came up with a t-shirt pattern, and it was a cross with one hand reaching down and another reaching up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the one reaching down was bigger than the one reaching up. And when we went down to Mexico, they found that offensive. The original, what it meant was the top hand was the hand of God. And
right.
Well, they took it as the top hand, meaning
we're the important folks coming down to help you.
The big Americans, and the little hand was representing the poor Mexicans.
Yes.
And one of the things in our cultural training that they taught us, that we shouldn't just go down there and be given to them in work and this and that, but be ready to accept from them. And,
that's right.
You know, we ate with them, and
that's right.
When we left, they gave us gifts, some of the gifts you would laugh at, unless you realize the context in which you were.
The symbolic quality of the gift. That's right.
And it makes a world of difference, and it changes that ugly American into somebody that, you know, will reach and help.
Right, and part of the ugly American issue is that we often assume that we are of superior status to the other folks. And if instead you can produce this norm of equality, and sometimes what you have to do is to suggest, is to show that you're willing to accept orders from them.
Right.
And that's to work on their marching orders instead of on your own. I know, Tom, you probably have a lot of experience with this in Indonesia, working with people who are going out into other cultures. And I suspect that it's there are similar issues in that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very... I wouldn't say rigid, but their expectations about what, you know, gift giving and things like that.
Right.
This term ole ole, which is basically bribes, but it means you bring somebody a pen or a keychain or, you know,
yes,
some little thing, and there's a custom for how you give it and when and all this stuff.
And you need to be aware of those. And one of the problems, of course, we find then is that we often impose our norms of equality, and norms of equality even differ across different cultures. What we mean when we say different people are equal is different across different cultures. So it's not, but at least within the American culture, you certainly need to produce those norms of equality and actual equality and intergroup contacts in order to get change in prejudice.
First time I went down to South America in the jungle, I was with my friends at his house, and these natives came, and they look up to, you know, Americans as something special. And he went in the house and they started talking to me, and I couldn't understand this language, and they went to another. They hit me with five different languages, and I couldn't understand, and my friend came out, and told them that I could only speak one language, and the looks on their face were just
amazed. I thought you were really funny.
Pity. Yeah, and they asked, well, how does he travel? How can he trade with his...
Right.
Because, you know, and that's part of cross-cultural trading, not only faking equality, but realizing an equality and seeing in them where they are.
That's
because
right.
For me to take off and try to go through the jungle would have been foolish. But you put yourself in their hands, and like
that's
I
right.
say, even let them see that they are superior to you
in many ways.
In language,
yeah.
In whatever way.
Yeah, yes.
I have often had a problem with this concept of equality because in the eyes of God, we are all equal from a love standpoint. From a talent, ability, capability standpoint, we are not equal.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to recognize is that what I have, you may not have. What I don't have, you may have. And this is, I think, where we get the interdependence and the communication. If we can accept others' abilities that we don't have. And I think this is what humility is all about, too. I mean,
it certainly is.
Kind of fit in there.
It certainly is. And what you need, mutual independence is on this little list that I've got. It's crucial. But one of the things that, at least in American culture, we often bring in is that because people have one kind of expertise, they are often thought to have other kinds too. And so they're often allowed to lead because they're the boss in some other context. And instead, what you need to realize is that you have, when we talk about equality, what I mean by that is that who leads depend upon who has what talents at what time.
This guy may run the whole show, but this guy may run this aspect that this guy doesn't know anything about.
That's right.
And,
that's
I
right.
think this is what's more important than equality is recognition of other people and their talents and
yeah.
abilities.
There's one other thing on this list that I think is very, very important, and that is that that you have to have multiple contacts rather than just one. So, for instance, one of the difficulties with many of these sort of rescue mission type things that you've talked about, and I'm not talking particularly about any ones that you've participated in, but some that I've seen. Is that people go down and they do a thing and then they come back and they're able to talk about those people the way those people act. And all they've seen is one very narrow and limited aspect of those people. Prejudice works on what social psychologists call the subsetting model. And so people in the South who are prejudiced will say things like, some of my best friends are, and you have heard this too. And very often what that means is that I know one person or two people who are a member of that group, and I think they're okay. But I find them to be exceptional for that group. In general, I still think that blacks are lazy and dirty and all of the other stereotypical things that I'm willing to think about blacks. And so multiple contacts with multiple people in multiple situations help you to overcome or help to falsify and overcome the subsetting that we do with other groups. And it's only through those multiple, and I shouldn't just say multiple contacts, it's multiple people in the group, multiple roles that those people play, multiple times, all of that are really
part of the success of the things that I was talking about is the fact that when we go down there, we don't go down and start telling them this is what you should do. We put ourselves in the hands of the national leaders. They tell us what to do, instruct us how to do it, and we obey them. But the fact is, an American, especially when we go down to Mexico City and work in the dump, a rich American in a dump is a draw card.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the work that the national workers do after we leave.
That's right.
And this is important for us to remember, because some of the people that go down get so emotionally involved, it's hard for them to go back. And they go through a time of withdrawal when they see these little kids that they worked with and everything.
Uh-huh.
And the only redeeming thing is to realize that the Mexican national people are still working with them, and it's not just us going down there one time.
Yes.
And then...
Yes. And this is, in fact, my most visceral disagreement with evangelists who go around from country to country and from town to town in the United States. Very often what the evangelists do is come in and set up a big tent, and they preach and they save a lot of people, and then they take off. And they've not done any of the groundwork to involve people in the local churches, to
and
work
quite
in the
often
local
it's
churches.
Just like in our Sunday Bible study this morning, where the slave girl was freed from the demon that was with her.
Right.
But she wasn't just left there. And this is what happens quite often. They go and set up a tent, move out.
Yeah, and they disappear.
And unless there's somebody to take that slave girl and...
That's right. And it's the same issue in evangelism as it is in the kind of work that you're talking about. And it's harder.
Yeah.
Another thing that I've noticed is that... by just coming to work in a development situation, whether they have a right to expect it or not, they create an expectation that you'll be back.
Yes.
That they don't want just the commitment to come here for 3 weeks and do something. They want to know if you're coming back next year.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That is as much... We really like all the work you do, you know, come and do some more for us. It is, you need to get to know us.
Yes. You know, I'm thinking at St. Olaf we have a wonderful international studies program.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of leading a group of students to in a class in Jerusalem about social conflict, which is one place where some social conflict seems to occur regularly.
You have some material.
Yes. And but one of the things that has slowed me down a great deal in simply rushing off to Jerusalem is that I don't want to use other people's unhappiness for the edification of my students.
Yeah.
Instead, what I want to be able to do is to set up the contacts that would produce long-term work with folks, going back regularly and finding out how doing the class can help the people who are helping to teach us. And I think there are ways to do that, but I would rather do it slowly that way than rush down and play spectator at their misery. Which is too bad, because, gosh, I'd like to get to Jerusalem soon.
One of the most satisfying things of the things I did is, like, the first time I went down to work to the dumps in Mexico, I met this little girl named Rocky, and she was a typical child out of the dumps. Well, I get a periodical from them, and this last year, she graduated from high school with top honors, and... is going on to study to be a nurse and come right back in the same area. And this is a result more of the national workers that were there and stayed and, you know, encouraged her. One of the things we built was a shower place where they could take a shower, and then on the end of it where they could study. And we as rich Americans, we go down there and do very little thing. We just touch it, maybe thing, and then the national workers take over.
Right.
And that's where the
and that's where the real work is done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have expended our time. This has been another session that I certainly have had fun in, and that at least is my criteria. So thank you all.
Thank you.
For this week. It's been a party.
Good.